Hello and welcome to The Week in Art. I'm Ben Luke. This week, Tate Britain unveils the artist Keith Piper's response to a racist mural in its former restaurant, the Art Basel and UBS Art Market report, and a weaving by Annie Albers. Four years after Tate Britain closed its restaurant because Rex Whistler's murals on its walls contained racist imagery, it's unveiled the work it commissioned in response to Whistler's painting by the artist Keith Piper. I talked to Keith about the work. The annual Art Basel and UBS Art Market report was published on Wednesday and, as ever, reviews the status of the international art market. I speak to its author, the cultural economist and founder of the company Arts Economics, Claire McAndrew. And this episode's Work of the Week is with Verticals, one of Annie Albers' pictorial weavings made in 1946. It's a key piece in the exhibition Woven Histories, Textiles and Modern Abstraction, which arrived this week at the National Gallery of Art in Washington. I discuss the weaving with the show's curator, Lynn Cook. We have a new subscription offer for the Art Newspaper, up to 50% off our annual subscription packages. Visit theartnewspaper.com to find out more. Do also subscribe to this podcast and to our sister podcast, A Brush With, wherever you're listening, and please also give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Now, the restoral at the former National Gallery of British Art, which then became the Tate Gallery and is now Tate Britain, was once described as the most amusing room in Europe because of the fanciful mural around its walls by the British artist Rex Whistler. Called The Expedition in Pursuit of Rare Meats, it was completed in 1927 when Whistler was just 21. But in the past decade, there's been a growing awareness of and outrage at racist passages in the work, including images of a black child being kidnapped from his mother, who is pictured naked in a tree. The child is then enslaved and appears chained in multiple scenes in the mural. Elsewhere, there are caricatures of Chinese figures. The restaurant had closed in March 2020 as part of the response to the COVID pandemic, but never reopened. And in December of that year, the gallery announced that it had started a consultation on what to do next about the mural, which is not a formally Tate accessioned artwork, but is part of an architecturally listed building. The group formed to discuss the mural described the conversations as difficult, with deep disagreement among the panel, but the conclusion was to commission an artwork from a contemporary artist. The result, a two-screen video installation by the veteran of the 1980s black art group, Keith Piper, opened this week at Tate Britain. Called Viva Voce, it imagines a conversation between Whistler and a contemporary art historian called Professor Shepherd. I went to Tate Britain to talk to Keith about the work. Keith, when the Tate announced in, I think it was 2022, that they wanted to do a series of artist installations in response to the Rex Whistler mural, Amir Srinivasan made a really interesting comment in that release. She said, "Could the space be used by artists as a creative site of reappropriation, or would this unfairly burden them with a problem produced by a historically white institution?" Did you have any pause before you accepted this commission? Was it a difficult commission to accept in some ways?
I had a pause in that I kind of fully understood the kind of implications of the work and of the questions around the work, especially in relationship to the wider conversations in terms of how museums can deal with objects which are problematic. Because museums are full of objects which have a very specific history, and that history may be kind of difficult for contemporary audiences. However, I'm strongly of the view that those objects need to stay and need to be analysed. They need to be deconstructed in order to increase our understanding of the intricacies of history. This is a thing which we need to grapple with. And so I kind of understood that there had been calls for the work to come down or be removed. And I also understood that wouldn't necessarily be possible. So therefore, the task of attempting to engage with the work had to be done. In terms of the history of my own work, I mean, I've kind of spent 40 years odd attempting to explore history, explore difficult images and difficult objects. And so I felt that, yes, this was a project which I felt I could take on. And also, you know, because I welcome that conversation. I welcome both the conversation with individuals who think work should come down or be hidden, and also those individuals on the other side of the spectrum who argue that that act of history should be left alone. And I wanted to engage both of those things because, you know, my position is different to both of those.
I wanted to explore that aspect of keeping it, because it's not that sort of mantra that's been trotted out by the British government endlessly, which is about retain and explain, is it?
Yes,
this is retain and transform or something in that territory.
It's retain and then deconstruct.
Yeah.
And then deconstruction is actually a transformative act if it brings new knowledge and new light both to the object itself and to our understanding of the history that made the object.
When I knew that you were doing this, I was intrigued to see how you do it, because there's a lot of collage in your previous work. There's a lot of the use of found materials and so on. And there is some of that in this work, but it is predominantly a kind of fictional conversation. So original material that you have shot. Tell us more about that decision. Why that rather than a much more collaged piece?
It was interesting because in terms of this particular project, I really wanted to kind of find a way in which it could actually explore the history of the work and also those things which made it problematic. I was immediately struck by the fact that he was a really young artist at the time. He was 21. Now, because I'm also based in a university, and so I'm speaking to kind of young artists all the time, and we kind of use a particular vehicle of the studio-based critique where you stand with that artist in front of their work, and you ask them, how did you come to this work? What else are you looking at? You know, who are you influenced by? And hold on, this part of the work is problematic. Have you thought about that? And so that whole vehicle of the studio critique, or in its most formal form, it's called viva voce. So I wanted to kind of use that particular form as a way of getting this imagined reconstruction of Rex Whistler to explain where the work had come from, you know, his influences, his process, you know, place it in history and in social history as well, place it in relationship to the other artworks that he was looking at, to place it in the context of other artworks from his practice as well at the same time, and to bring all of those things together in a kind of conversational way. I thought the kind of best way of doing that was by staging an imagined conversation between him and a kind of researcher, academic type of character.
And the academic is very clearly established. The opening shot of the film, the professor is sitting there doing her work, researching.
Yes, it's and I think, in the archive,
So in a way, while she is a fictional character, I wondered to what extent she is a kind of stand-in for you. She is an avatar for you to a certain extent, because you've obviously done a lot of research into this and it's sort of transparently presented through the piece.
That's interesting, yes. An avatar for me, but an avatar for a whole generation of art historical thought. So she is the stand-in for us all in terms of individuals who are attempting to kind of look at this history through its remnants and ask questions.
Yeah.
And a particular interpretation of the piece is that it could be in her imagination. She could be imagining this confrontation or this conversation with Rex Whistler, because we see her flashing in and out of the archive.
Yeah.
And so I wanted it to be quite ambiguous in terms of kind of where this conversation was placed.
Yeah.
And also when it was happening.
Yeah, and in terms of when it was happening, you bring in all sorts of the social and cultural events that happened around that time, like the general strike, like the exhibition in Wembley, you know, the Empire exhibition and so on, to establish the kind of culture in which Rex Whistler would have, or should have at least, come across black people. So he would have had a context in which to establish a view of black people.
Exactly. I mean, this is what we are attempting to arrive at. I think it becomes a problem if we attempt to kind of impose the kind of knowledge of our time on a historical figure. We have to, in a sense, establish what they would have been exposed to. You know, to ask questions about, okay, you are in the 1920s. How would you have encountered real-life black people? And obviously, there were black people in London at that time and in a whole range of places. And so it was the jazz age. He was a bright young thing. He would have encountered black jazz musicians. You know, in the war, he would have encountered black workers. You know, there are all of these ways in which he would have seen real-life black people. Mm-hmm. However, in his work, he was resorting to these very particular types of basic stereotypes. And so that question was, you were seeing people.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things is you absolutely don't let him off the hook. You don't give him that excuse of, oh, it was a common view in that age to have this view. Because what the professor does is point him in the direction of how he's depicting the black figures in the composition, yeah, and isolate, you know, why he might have arrived at those. And then brilliantly through the research, link it back to a much wider sort of story of his racist depictions, basically. Mm,
yes, absolutely. There is also a story of the stuff which didn't quite make this version of the work, in terms of it was in the script and we lost it from the script, etc., and we shot it but we didn't use it. And a part of that was actually a comparison with other artists of that time, of 1927, and how they had painted black people or depicted black people. So a really important one was from Stanley Spencer in a piece which was in the Tate at the time, so that was why it was a core part of the research, which was The Resurrection Cookham, which is a very interesting work indeed.
Major work in Tate's collection.
It's a major work, but they took it down. Because I actually had originally planned to actually shoot them in front of that piece, but it was gone. And that is such an interesting work in that context, because Stanley Spencer had actually gone out of his way to seek out images of black people which he could then copy in terms of his painting. Now, we find it difficult and problematic because he found those images in National Geographic, which, you know, to our frame of mind, is a highly problematic source.
Yeah.
However, you know, in terms of his motives, the motives of finding a way of kind of depicting realistic black figures, really important.
Yeah.
And we actually know that Rex Whistler saw that work. There is stuff in his diary about he saw it with Edith Olivier, and he didn't like it because it was badly composed. You know, it's all that kind of stuff. So it's also thinking about what were other artists doing at this time.
Right. And you mentioned Edith Olivier, and she's a kind of key factor in the extremity of the language, isn't she?
Yes, yes.
You use this text, which was written, as it says in the film, with Whistler himself. And we see her read out excerpts from it. It's shocking in the same way that the imagery is shocking. And what's intriguing is that that wasn't published. It was rejected by publishers. And of course, our minds immediately think, well, why was it rejected? But then you don't let the institution off the hook, because then by 1954, so 6 years after Windrush, this deeply racist text is being published. And in a way, you're not letting the Tate off the hook any more than you're letting the artist off the hook.
That is interesting, because, yes, it was published then. It's interesting to compare the version of the text, which was published in 1954, with the original manuscript.
Right.
Which is actually in the Tate archive. And it's sort of clear that that was the manuscript which was written in the late 1920s, because it even calls the Tate, not the Tate, the National
Gallery of British Art, as it was.
Art, as it was, which really places it in history. They are pretty much the same. However, there are some slight changes to the language.
Right.
And it was interesting as to why it wasn't published in 1927. There is additional research to be done there.
Right.
But I think it's just really interesting.
Yeah.
It's a very strange piece of writing. It's difficult to read. I only know a few people who managed to actually read it all the way through, because it's very convoluted and dense.
I want to ask you about when you were filming the really problematic elements of this work. You had to train your camera on this deeply offensive imagery. I wonder how it felt. You know, you knew you had to record these details. What did it feel like to actually focus on those details in a relatively unprecedented way? Because this work's been kind of background its whole life, and now it's foreground.
That's interesting. It is, because I suppose in my own practice, I'm not unused to looking at some difficult images. However, what I've noticed within the staging of the work, images which on the wall are just a few inches big are suddenly floor to ceiling in the projection. So there's a different kind of relationship with that. So I find that quite fascinating. And so when the image of the child is on screen and it's floor to ceiling, it takes on this whole other kind of power, which is surprising. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, when I encountered that, I thought, yeah, that's operating in a slightly different way to how I had imagined, because obviously I'd been seeing this image just on the screen of my computer when it carries a different kind of resonance when it's this large.
And so in relation to that, obviously there will be text outside that will explain the context of this work. But I imagine you're prepared that a lot of people will find it difficult to watch this film as well as engage with it.
Difficult to watch. I think that's an interesting thing. In a sense, I'm sort of old-fashioned in that I'm still of the school of thought which thinks that art can be challenging. It can make particular demands on the viewer.
Should be challenging to a degree.
Yeah, should be challenging. And so, yes, the work is engaging with a very difficult topic. I'm hoping that it kind of passes through a range of stages which allows us to kind of discuss the work, to look at the work historically, to look at it in terms of its influences, to look at it in terms of its context, all those kind of things, and to look at that very difficult content that's in the work.
Returning to Whistler's position in all of this, one of the ways in which you illustrate how he clearly knew what he was doing is by isolating the details that show that the black child and the black woman in the tree are between a self-portrait and a portrait of Stephen Tennant.
Oh,
effectively.
Right, that's interesting. Yes, and yes. Yeah.
So the idea that it could be a sort of small and fun detail, which is what Whistler says, it was just a sort of bit of fun, becomes more and more implausible when you think of how it's positioned, because there we have a kind of autobiographical presentation, a kind of sense in which, you know, that's a key detail in the work. And also in the text, the figure of the child becomes a key factor in helping them find all these wonderful delights that are eventually presented at the end of the work. So it's that implication of Whistler's intention.
That is fascinating, because it's the first time that I've kind of heard that, and it's an extremely valid observation and a really interesting one. The particular take which I have on that, which is also one which emerged through the research around the work, is that there's always been a question around how much Whistler was aware or conscious of the actual story whilst he was planning the work and making the work, or was it something which was constructed afterwards, mostly by Edith Olivier? And I've heard various different takes on that. However, in this work, there is a sort of important moment which also reflects my own research process, because I was unsure about that because I'd heard so many different things until I actually filmed the preparatory drawings of the mural, and there are small copies of them in the Tate archive. However, the original ones, which apparently are larger, are in the Whistler archive in Salisbury, which we were unable to kind of get into. And in the drawings, it's clear that he's annotated these figures in advance. So in what looks like, I mean, to me, an initial sketch for the work, already against the figure, there's the word Negro, and the figure in the tree, Negro's mum. And so we have that also in the work. It appears in the work. And so that would seem to suggest that in advance, when he was at the planning stage of this work, that particular story was already the kind of key driver of the whole thing. And I think that is a piece of evidence which really, I feel, pins down that argument. You know, the story came in advance of the mural, and he was, in a sense, illustrating this story, which him and Edith were like telling each other.
Yeah. Lastly, one of the things that really becomes clear through talking to you is that this is the first step, isn't it? The story is much broader. I can even see that you could make several versions of this work, actually, because it's such a rich territory to explore. For instance, there's a hint of Florence Mills in the work. You see a poster for one of her performances, and she was an enormously famous performer in 1920s America and then London, and apparently the future Edward VIII was obsessed and went to see her work numerous times.
Really?
And so on.
I didn't
she was
know
an
that.
Absolute,
I didn't,
yeah, she
I
was
didn't
a superstar
actually know
of the age.
That Edward VIII, because we do talk about Edward VIII in terms of the Gargoyle Club.
Yeah.
And obviously, Edward VIII was kind of reflective of a very particular kind of politics in the 1920s. And the Florence Mills thing also is really interesting. And we're actually looking for archival documentation of actual black American jazz musicians, which he would have seen
exactly
in 1926, 27, 28. And obviously she is key. And the way that we've actually worked with that is within the soundtrack. Now, at moments in the soundtrack, there's a violin, which is violin play by a really interesting sound artist that I also teach with, called Tansy Spinks. And we actually listened to some of the work of Florence Mills, and we attempted to kind of work with some of the harmonic themes within Florence's work, but to slow them down and make them really kind of ominous. And so it is variations on a piece of work by Florence Mills that you're hearing in terms of the violin track within the work.
Well, Keith, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, yes.
Viva Voci is in the former restaurant at Tate Britain for at least a year. You can read more on this story on the website or on our app for iOS and Android. Coming up, the key findings in this year's Art Basel UBS Art Market Report and Annie Albers in Washington. That's after this week's news bulletin. Employees, fellows and volunteers at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York have signed an open letter to the director and chief executive, Max Hollein, calling on the institution to, quote, take a stand in defence of Palestinians and the cultural heritage of Palestine amid Israel's continued bombing of Gaza. On Monday, museum workers delivered the open letter to Hollein, asking for the museum to publish a statement calling for the bombing to end. More than 31,000 Palestinians have been reported killed since the 7th of October last year, when around 1,200 Israelis were reportedly killed and about 250 taken hostage in a Hamas terrorist attack in Israel. In addition to the loss of human life, many important buildings in Gaza, including numerous mosques, have been damaged and destroyed. The letter argues that there is precedence for the Met speaking out on the protection of cultural heritage sites in times of conflict in relation to Afghanistan, Iran, and Ukraine. The German government and 16 states approved reforms aimed at helping the heirs of Jewish collectors to recover Nazi-looted art. Most importantly, the introduction of binding arbitration for claims to replace the current advisory commission, which has no legal means to enforce its recommendations. The reforms, which do not require parliamentary approval, also grant claimants unilateral access to arbitration, in contrast to the current system, under which both parties in a dispute must agree before a claim can be submitted for evaluation. Claudia Roth, the German culture minister, said in a statement released after a meeting on Wednesday of government and state culture officials that they aim to implement the reforms before the end of 2024. She hailed the decisions as a big and important step forward to considerable improvements in the return of Nazi-looted art. Anya Galaccio and Harold Offey are among five artists shortlisted to create a permanent HIV/AIDS memorial in London, more than 40 years after the UK's first AIDS case was reported in December 1981. The overdue memorial will be located close to the former Middlesex Hospital in Fitzrovia, where the UK's first dedicated AIDS unit was opened by Princess Diana in 1987. The charity behind the memorial, AIDS Memory UK, says the public artwork will, quote, acknowledge an increasingly forgotten period in British history and the lessons we learned from that time. The artists Ryan Gander, Sharpur Puyan and Diana Puntar are also on the shortlist. All five have submitted initial proposals that are currently being worked up for submission. The winning proposal will be announced this summer, with the work due to be unveiled in 2026. To read these stories and much more, visit the website or the app. Now, before our next item, the US artist Joan Jonas this week opens major survey exhibitions at both the Museum of Modern Art and the Drawing Centre in New York. Last year, I had an in-depth conversation with Joan Jonas on our sister podcast, A Brush With, and here she is discussing drawing.
I always try to find a way to use drawing. It could relate to the meaning of the piece, the text. Like when I began to use video, I consciously drew in relation to the video camera. Or I drew in relation to the audience, or I drew on a blackboard. When I draw in a performance, the performance affects the way I draw because I'm not thinking consciously, I'm just making the drawing. And the drawing has to be an integral part. And I don't treat the drawings that I make as precious. I don't want the audience to say, oh, she's making a drawing, we have to save it.
You can find A Brush with Joan Jonas wherever you're listening now. Her exhibition Animal, Vegetable, Mineral is at the Drawing Centre in New York until the 2nd of June. And her Museum of Modern Art retrospective, Good Night, Good Morning, opens on Sunday, the 17th of March and continues to the 6th of July. Now, each year, Claire McAndrew, a cultural economist who specialises in the arts, antiques and collectibles markets and is the founder of the company Arts Economics, writes a much-anticipated art market report. Though sponsored by the Art Basel Art Fair and the bank UBS, it's an independent and objective analysis and looks at sales and other activities across art market sectors, including auction houses, art fairs, galleries and collectors. Through the data it gathers, the report attempts to identify current economic and geographical trends in the market. I spoke to Claire about this report. Claire, last year on this podcast, I talked to Tim Schneider and other members of our market team, and we were talking a lot about a kind of middling year of a fairly damp squib. The sort of headline figure in terms of the downturn in the market is 4%. Is that as expected, or is that perhaps slightly less than expected?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we actually probably had a pretty good run for 2 years after the pandemic. You know, the market was growing, even though it wasn't the greatest year last year. You know, it did kind of lift itself out of the hole from 2020 quite well in 2021 as well. And the market had hit close to its highest level in 2022. So it was 68 billion. It was the second highest ever level. And I think when it gets to that size, it is slightly inevitable in this kind of market that's driven by scarcity that sales may slow down. And I think talking to a lot of businesses operating in the market in the final quarter of last year, especially, I think a lot of people were bracing for a bigger drop in sales. So the fact that it was not quite as bad as it anticipated was quite a positive thing. But it was a very mixed picture, depending on who you spoke to as well. And I think that's one of the big features we've seen is this divergence in performance, both between, when I'm looking at it from a very macro point of view, both between different regions and different value segments in the market. And that's kind of what's muting the changes in some of the sales figures for the last 2 years, keeping them less dramatic. It was the same case in 2022, but in a completely different direction this year. So that was kind of interesting to see the changes.
One of the things I've got used to talking about on the podcast, it's about how the high end, the 1%, the top end of the market is often the most buoyant and it's sort of supporting all the other levels to a certain extent. This time, that's not the case, is it? Tell us about those headline figures relating to the sort of highest level sales.
Well, this was a very important issue, I think, last year. So it was very much the case in 2021 and 2022 that the high end was really what was driving the market's recovery. And that really turned around last year. So if you look at the dealer segment, the businesses with, say, 10 million plus in sales had been by far the strongest performers prior to last year. And the smaller businesses still struggling a little bit kind of post-COVID. And this turned around last year. So we saw the 10 million plus dealers had the biggest drop in sales on average of 7%. And all the businesses that operating below that, say the sub 500,000 level, had an increase on average of 11%. And it was crystal clear in the auction sector. And I think this is fascinating to look at when we have that micro level transaction data, that the 10 million plus segment really thinned out. And that's what really led to this sharp decline in values at auction as well. And, you know, it's really interesting because 2020, everybody dropped. 2021, all these segments increased. And then it started to split. And you can see this in the auction sector in 2022. It was actually the 10 million plus segment was the only one to show an increase. We had all those fabulous sales, the Paul Allen sale and all these lots selling for over 100 million. So it was kind of a hard act to follow. But 2023, the 10 million plus segment showed one of the worst performances. The number of lots sold over 10 million was down by a quarter. And the value in that segment fell by about 40%. Versus kind of low positive growth in the market under 50,000. So when I say more than 10 million, it's really the 50 million plus segment that takes a huge chunk out of the picture. So there's about 20 less of those in the market last year versus 2022. And that's, you know, 1.5 to 2 million worth of sales taken out of the market. So this is what caused the kind of contraction, much less of those very high results at auction. And that caused the market overall to fall by about 7%.
Right. To what extent are you able to sort of drill down into those figures and say, well, hang on, is this about nervousness amongst the big collections? People thinking, well, this is not the best time to bring my work to auctions. Is it about nervousness amongst collectors to spend the money? Can you detect in the data what is the sort of key driver of that fall at the highest end?
I mean, I think it stays very much a supply-driven marketplace, and I think it's how vendors particularly, it's still so dominant by a lot of those 1 million plus works, both in the dealer and auction sector, are secondary market sales. And it's how vendors perceive the market is at the time. You know, if they don't have to sell at a particular time, they might hold back if they think it's not a good time to sell. And we had such a complex kind of year last year, politically, you know, economically, there was a lot of worries. We did kind of avoid a lot of the worst of some of the economic issues, but there was a lot of complexity and anxiousness. And I think people that were more risk averse would hold back a little bit and just see how things pan out. If you didn't have to sell it, you might be advised to just hang on a little bit. And I think we saw a little bit of that. And I was amazed also because I always knew that high net worth and ultra high net worth used a lot of leverage and lending for buying. But we did a survey at the end of last year of collectors that I do with UBS. And it was amazing to see the amount of collectors that use loans and lending and credit to finance purchases in their collections. So the interest rate environment, I think, probably had a little bit of a knock-on effect for that as well.
That's really interesting because I was going to ask you, there's this, as you say, the sort of lower end of the market has had a good year. There's been a substantial growth in that market. Is that because people are buying at lower price points, or is that another environment entirely? So in other words, is there a newer kind of collector who's buying at that lower level? Or is it simply the richest people actually thinking, well, I'm not going to spend a million on an artwork, I'm going to spend 100,000 or 10,000?
I would love to think it's a little bit of both. I'd love to think there's more kind of collectors coming into the market, but I think it was getting away from the quantitative kind of surveys and looking at the data, but talking to people, they said it was easier to make a sale at a lower price point to the same types of collectors. So I think there was a nervousness about spending larger sums. And it's such a mood-driven market, as you know, the demand might be there if vendors would bring the things to market, but it's the sense that it's not a good time to sell that's holding them back, even though people are generally waiting in the wings if the right material does show up.
Another thing I wanted to ask is, to what extent is it also about different kinds of artists that collectors are buying and so on? So artists who perhaps might be on the brink of a major position in the art world, whether that's historical figures on the secondary market or contemporary figures, who collectors are experimenting with. Is there any way of detecting that kind of stuff? So, for instance, people are choosing, instead of spending a lot of money on a Rothko, are buying a work by an artist who may be from the same period as Rothko, but has not achieved that level of kind of household name identity, if you like.
Again, I mean, we don't go into that level of detail in this particular report, but I would love to think that people are experimenting more and that's what's driven the lower price points. But I'm not sure that is the case, because with the kind of uncertainty and risk aversion comes a tendency to kind of anchor on fairly well-established names. So, you know, it's kind of not necessarily a time for experimentation. And even some of the galleries and dealers that I spoke to that were kind of cognizant of that and kind of altering even the kind of content of the works they brought to art fairs, for example. We saw paintings had a much higher share of dealer sales than other mediums. And that's always the case, but it bumped up again last year. So we don't go to the level of granularity of by artists, but the kind of evidence on the surface of it would be that, if anything, there was a tendency to stick to slightly more traditional mediums and segments than there was in previous years.
There's another factor in the data which seems to suggest a conservatism, which is the fact that private sales went up. Tell us why private sales might have gone up.
I think this tends to happen in these kind of uncertain times. You know, if a market's buoyant and things are looking up, the sky's the limit at auction. You know, you can make much better than anticipated gains from bringing something to auction, better than you might be able to negotiate in a kind of quiet, sober, rational deal if bidding just takes off. But when there's a sense that the market might be going down, there is that risk of bringing things into public sale, that it'll be on public record that a work sold for a less than ideal price or that doesn't sell at all. And this does tend to push people into the private sector, whether it's either private sales at auction houses or buying and selling through galleries. And we have seen that in buoyant markets, the auction sector really kind of rockets ahead. And then in less certain or downward markets, the dealer sector and private sales tend to do much better. And that's certainly been the case the last couple of years.
Now, transaction volume increased. Is that a sort of temporary blip? Is that, again, about people spending less money? Or are there more people swilling around buying artwork? What does transaction volume increase actually tell us about in terms of a trend?
It's the same kind of deal here. I mean, if you look at fine art auction sales, for example, because that's where we have the good kind of transaction level data, you know, 90% of the sales that take place in the market every year, not just last year, but every year, are in the sub 50,000 segment. And this is the market that was doing pretty well last year. So the majority of sales at auction are actually below 5,000. All the media focus is always on these very small number of things at the high end, but it was the kind of low positive growth in those lower value segments that has taken off. And I mean, again, it's very difficult to track the numbers of buyers that are involved in these transactions. That would be a fascinating study to do if we possibly could. But they were the most popular price points were the lower ones last year. And they're the ones where there was a little bit of buoyancy in the market, which was a kind of a green shoot, I suppose.
Can we start looking at the different markets now? Because one of the things that it would suggest is that the UK's down, China's moved up into second place. So that suggests a good year for China and a bad year for the UK. But it's not as simple as that, is it?
No, I think, I mean, the UK to me has been like a picture of what resilience is all about since COVID. It's had COVID, Brexit, all these things it's been dealing with, and it's managed to grow for 2 years in 2021 and 2022. And we saw, again, a slightly inevitable decline in 2023 of 8% to just under 11 billion. And the thing about the UK is it's a kind of a key hub for those very high-end sales, which were thinner, or there's a little bit more pressure on that segment last year. So it was the kind of lack of those sales that probably caused the decline. And there was also a slowdown in imports as well coming into the UK. So they're the things that we really have to watch for. China was a complete bright spot in the declining market as well. And that was quite specific to some of the things that were going on in China last year. The fact that 2022 was a really bad year for China, it was still in full pandemic lockdown mode in many regions. The market was down 14% in 2022. But then when they reopened in January 2023, we had this kind of surge of activity, this uplift and injection of sales into the market as, you know, the postponed inventories were sold and people were coming back to fairs and exhibitions after being in lockdown for much of the previous year. So the first half of the year in China was much higher. So there are quite specific circumstances to the year, I think, that caused the different dynamics. And there's constant reshuffling of positions between China and the UK over the last several years, which has been really interesting to watch.
Now, one of the things that people like me who are so depressed about Brexit have long argued is that it's going to be terrible for the art market. And year after year, there's been this sort of consistent thing which has said, well, actually, Brexit hasn't been that bad for the art market. The UK, though, hasn't returned to 2019 levels. Is that a Brexit factor or is it much more complicated than that?
I think it definitely has been. I mean, the UK is a hub for international trade and it's the key hub in Europe really for imports and exports of art. And although most of the transactions by value are from third countries, so the biggest trade that the UK does in terms of, you know, importing art is probably with, you know, the US and Asia and other places, the impact of greater tariffs in Europe also has an impact. And I think there is a sense that if you look at big companies that have the choice, like Christie's or Sotheby's, that have the choice of selling anywhere and in a whole kind of range of different jurisdictions, they will choose the one that vendors find the most attractive from a regulatory point of view as well. And I think what's tending to happen is, and it's been happening for a number of years with Europe in general, is that the US and Hong Kong and places like that are seen as kind of easier and more efficient in terms of additional cost places to transact. And this is an issue that we're seeing in the UK. And while the UK had a chance to kind of break out of some of those regulations, so it's not tied as much to the directives that it once was, that hasn't changed. It's still the status quo there. So I think this is going to be important looking forward as to how the UK can maintain its position as a trade hub, because that's really what drives the market. It's not just people from the UK buying British artists' material in the UK. It's a critical mass of material that comes together in London from all places being sold to British collectors as well as collectors from all around the world. So the kind of the trade situation is something that's going to be key over the next few years.
I noticed that the sort of alarming statistics seem to be relating to imports in the sense that the imports are 26% lower than they were in 2019 in the UK. So that seems like a really notable number.
Yeah, no, it is. It's considerably lower. And again, this is the thing that the art market is grappling with now, is to kind of find ways to make that an easier process. There is ways to kind of get around import VAT with temporary admissions and different things. But I think it's just the idea that if it's a more complicated place to do business, why not just do it somewhere like New York, where you don't have all this hassle? And this is kind of what is driving the sense of choice for vendors. They're choosing locations where they know they'll have strong demand and where it's an easy place to do business. So this is really what the market has to look at, I think, going forward.
Lastly, NFTs. We've been talking about the decline in art NFTs and the market for them for some time. Your report reinforces that to a certain extent. Do you think it's in terminal decline, or might it revive, do you think?
I know we were so overdosing on information on NFTs in 2021 that nobody wants to really talk about them anymore. And the market has declined quite significantly. It was close to $3 billion in 2021 at that peak. And then it's had 2 years of declining sales, including a 50% drop last year to $1.2 billion. This is art-related NFTs. So we're talking about the sales on platforms outside of the traditional art market on NFT platforms. But when you look a bit closer at the data, there is still spikes of activity last year even, and you'll see particular projects by artists are generating, you know, multiple $1 million sales. And I think it's actually become a little bit more interesting and a little bit more driven by artistic projects and by art instead of just by speculation. And I think that whole speculative activity that dominated the market so much is actually kind of running out of steam a little bit. And the purely speculative people they've either moved into collectibles or they're just holding on, realizing that they're going to sell at a loss. And a lot of activity is actually driven by the artistic side of things, which is, I think, is a very positive development in the art market. The figures don't look positive, but the actual activity that's going on is slower. And in terms of the turnaround is slower as well. And it's that kind of very famous statistic that I just sticks in my mind that we got from the NFT data people we work with, that in 2021, the turnaround for art-related NFT was 33 days. So that was the average period someone would buy it and sell it for. I mean, it's crazy. When you think about the art market from the kind of academic studies we've done, is about 30 years. So that's still what you're dealing with, 30 days to 30 years. So now if we can get just kind of meet somewhere in the middle, I think we're looking at a much more stable market, and one that's driven by the art itself rather than whether you're going to make money out of it quickly or not.
Well, Claire, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
You can find the report at theartmarket.artbasel.com. And finally, it's time for the work of the week. This year is a bumper year for textiles and art, as Adriano Pedrosa, the artistic director of this year's Venice Biennale, told this podcast last month. Fabric works are a leitmotif running through his international exhibition opening in Venice next month. Several other shows are reflecting on textiles' increasing importance in modern and contemporary art, including the current exhibition at the Barbican Art Gallery in London, Unravel, which tours to the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam later this year. This week, the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. opens Woven Histories, Textiles and Modern Abstraction, which will later travel to Ottawa and New York. It features 160 works by more than 50 artists from across the world and multiple generations, all of whom have used weaving and related techniques to develop the language of abstraction. Among the key figures in the modernist history of textiles is the Bauhaus artist Annie Albers, and among the works by her in Woven Histories is With Verticals from 1946, an example of what Albers herself called pictorial weaving. Lynn Cook is the curator of the exhibition, and I spoke to her about the piece. Lynn, where was Annie Albers when she made this extraordinary piece?
She was at Black Mountain College in North Carolina. She had arrived in 1933 with Joseph Albers, escaping the rise of the Nazis in Germany. And she was teaching weaving to the students at this liberal art college.
Yes, and she obviously had made extraordinary work already at the Bauhaus at that stage. Is there something significant that happens to her work once she's in the US? Does her work shift at all?
Yes, it shifts radically. At the Bauhaus, she worked in what we could call a constructivist vocabulary, geometric abstraction, making designs for mass-produced textiles, for furnishings and interiors and perhaps a little for apparel, and also making what were called wall hangings, which were decorative tapestry-like weavings for interiors to hang on walls. When she came to the US and took up this teaching position, her looms had not arrived, and she began teaching the students with exercises using materials to hand. That included corn kernels, bits of natural vegetation, and all sorts of other things. Once the looms were there and she started weaving again, she started from a very different position from where she'd been before, I think. And there are not a great many works extant from between about 1937-38 and 1950, when Joseph and Annie moved to Yale University, where he has a teaching position. The works in this interval between the later 30s and the later 40s begin with what could be seen as a continuation of the Bauhaus language, but interleaved with motifs from pre-Columbian architecture, Aztec architecture, that they were seeing on trips to Mexico in particular.
It's difficult to overstate the importance of those trips, isn't it? Because they really were so formative. So many of her ideas emerged from them, her exposure to all sorts of cultural artifacts in that time.
Yes, of course, she'd already known about pre-Columbian textiles from her time in Berlin and at the Bauhaus in Weimar and Dessau. Pre-Columbian textiles were very much admired, as was the whole culture, by the early 20th century through the excavations of German archaeologists and others. But she had a chance, of course, to see things in person through these trips. The interesting thing for me with verticals is it moves beyond the language of direct reference in, say, a work called Monte Album. And there's really nothing with this specific vocabulary in her oeuvre, nothing that follows, nothing quite like it before. And as a work of weaving, it's really a tour de force. It's got a very different vocabulary and a highly complex and yet seemingly very simple iconography of dark lines, thin diagonal stripes, moving left, moving right, that make up the field.
One of the things about the piece that we're talking about with verticals is that it's very large, and it's one of her very largest pieces. Is that right?
It is. It's on the large size. She'd made works during the Bauhaus years which were comparable, a little larger, a little not so wide. And then she would make these commissions in the 50s for the doors of the Torah in synagogues that were quite large also. But it's certainly one of a relatively small number.
There's a limited sort of colour palette in with verticals, in terms of there's reds and there's these sort of black seam, the actual verticals of the title. So tell us about that structure.
There are only three colours, I think. There's the red, there's the natural linen, and the vertical bars, which are in black and which appear to lie behind this surface of diagonals moving in bands left and right irregularly across the surface. And the placement of the black bars, which are all of the same width but not of the same height, appears to have no system to it. It's not a mathematical progression or not a based on some recognizable pattern. It's organized intuitively, in a sense, and yet the overall impression is of extraordinary animation and balance at the same time. And this, as a compositional structure, is not only hard to resolve, but when she's weaving it, she probably cannot see the whole thing as she makes it, and there are no extant drawings and no indication that she made preliminary drawings for it. There are no studies really for anything like this in her work.
One of the things that I'm struck by, again, looking at this work, is the optical effects. Can you tell us about what it's like to stand in front of it, Lynn? Because, of course, there's the structure, but once you're up close to it, all sorts of other things happen visually.
Once you're in front of it, and it's a big field, it's like a metre and a half tall and more than a metre wide, If you stand near it, your field of vision is fully engaged. You're much more aware of how this continuous field of narrow red and cream stripes are moving, and they're unpredictably shifting from a 45-degree angle left to a 45-degree angle right. And those shifts are happening, as I said, irregularly, because she's not even working with one direction of stripes, diagonals all the way across the width of the field. She will shift and it will go from diagonal left to diagonal right. Sometimes when it hits one of these black bars, but sometimes in the middle of the black bar or sometimes beyond the black bar. And mapping what this underlying very dynamic field would look like as an armature would be hard to do. It appears as a kind of very animated, very rich interplay between the two colors, and one that's hard to hold down because you can't find a system, and yet is extremely satisfying, musical, one might say. Trying to find anything amongst well-known works of art that it relates to, perhaps the nearest thing I can think of are those Pier and Ocean drawings that Mondrian made in the teens or at the turn of the 20s, where you have a somewhat related syncopation of lines against a continuous ground.
One of the things that's wonderful, I think, about this piece is that the way that it engages with the past in terms of abstraction, but also, of course, looks to the future. And it's difficult to, again, to overstate the importance of Annie Albers to the history of textiles in the 20th century, but also looking forwards, right? Because she's such an exemplar of creativity within textiles and textiles as art.
Yes. One of the reasons why I chose this work is because it's pivotal, and yet it doesn't relate formally and compositionally very closely to the work made in Europe, nor does it relate formally and compositionally to the works that begin in 1949 with what she calls pictorial weavings. And these are usually smaller works with very experimental weave structures where the pattern or the design comes out of the choice of the texture of thread and the dimension of thread. And pictorial weavings is her term, and these are autonomous artworks, not utilitarian textiles, and they are meant to be shown in galleries and museums in direct company with the work of her painting peers, like Paul Klee, for example. So they're painting-adjacent textile artworks. And that was a wholly new typology in her practice, and one that was immensely influential going forward. Her influence, I think, extends beyond her immediate practice to her vision for textiles, its relationship to modern architecture and its dialogue with that, and her ideas of having a practice that designed for high-end mass production and made artworks in parallel. She manifests her thinking in her practice, but her ideas are also spread very extensively through her book On Weaving, which is published in the later 60s and really is perhaps the best known text on weaving in the 20th century and has been immensely influential within the US and beyond.
Lynn, thank you so much.
Thank you too, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
Woven Histories, Textiles and Modern Abstraction is at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. from the 17th of March to the 28th of July. It then travels to the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa from the 25th of October to the 2nd of March next year. And then it's at the Museum of Modern Art in New York from the 20th of April 2025 to the 13th of September. And that's it for this episode. You can find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Tone Audio, and on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. The Week in Art is produced by Julia Mahalska, Alexander Morrison, and David Clack. And David's also the editor and sound designer. Thanks also to Daniela Hathaway and to our guests, Keith, Claire, and Lynn. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.